All right, so I'm very glad to be here in Toronto and to get a chance to talk with you all today. But I just wanted to first acknowledge my collaborators here. A lot of the work has been done with the people who are listed here on projects in South America. But I'm going to start off today by talking to you about what are you looking at here on this Physics Today cover. So maybe you received a copy of this and you're wondering, what exactly is this? And so I'll spend what I'll call the first act of this talk today talking a little bit about what you're looking at, what this measurement is, how it works, and a little bit about the physics behind the measurement and what we're measuring and why we care about it. And then I'll try to give you a couple of examples from my own work, particularly focusing in South America, particularly focusing in Act 2 on magma migration that we've discovered at supposedly dormant volcanoes by signatures of the ground deformation. And then I'll also finally talk about a little bit about earthquake activity and measurements that we can make of deformation that might be occurring before earthquakes. So we're not exactly talking about earthquake prediction here, but earthquake triggering at least by these types of aseismic motions. So hopefully at least some of these ideas will at least have some relevance to keep you interested through the first part where we'll talk about the details. But when I wrote this article for Physics Today, it was a lot of fun to write this and to talk with the editors at this magazine, but they really fell in love with this particular image here, which is, as I'll describe, is a 2003 earthquake in Iran, which happened to be an earthquake that I did not study myself. But they loved this image much more than the ones of my own that I'll show you later on. So I will start off by describing this. This is work that's been done primarily by Yuri Fialko in San Diego and by Gareth Funing, who was at Oxford at the time. The first thing I need to tell you is that the editor at Physics Today decided to orient the cover not quite right. We have to rotate it 90 degrees to get north pointing in the right direction. So first of all, this is a remote sensing satellite image from radar, and I'll describe that we're looking at both the amplitude of the radar return signal as well as the phase information, and that's what we make the interferogram. But just to orient you as to where in the world you are and what you're looking at, so this is an earthquake that occurred in a very tectonically active area in southeastern Iran. It's an area that has numerous earthquakes. It's an area of active collision between the Arabian Plate and the Eurasian Plate, forming the Zagros Mountains, for example. And this sort of shows you a zoom-in area from a sort of an optical image that shows you this. It's in a very arid region here in the deserts of southeastern Iran. And the city here is a relatively old city, perhaps 2,000 years old, because it's sort of an oasis and it's known for its fig growth, for example, and dates and other things that they grow there. And this earthquake occurred on December 26, 2003, on a previously unknown fault. So this was an area that was known to be tectonically active, but trying to figure out exactly where the next earthquake is going to occur is kind of tricky because the earthquakes occur over several hundred kilometer area. And so, in fact, this particular fault that ruptured in this case was not previously known. So first we have to put a human face on this particular thing before we talk about the scientific aspects of it. It was a great human tragedy. It was a city that was primarily built out of mud huts that had been built for several thousands of years there. And in fact, there was this famous tourist destination of this citadel that was in fact mostly destroyed by this particular event. So this is one of the things that we always have to remember, that before focusing on the science, that there is a human impact to the things that we're studying, and there's a reason for trying to understand what happened to the Earth in this particular event, and can we learn anything from that to help us in hazard mitigation for the future. All right, so as I briefly mentioned, that what you're looking at here is an image that's showing you both phase information and amplitude images taken from a satellite. In this case, the satellite is the European Space Agency Omvisat satellite, which is able to use SAR, which is a synthetic aperture radar, which is a technique of imaging radar, which is you're sending microwave beams down, in this case, in the realm of about 1 gigahertz, which comes out to a few centimeters of wavelength, propagates through clouds. You're able to see at night. So it's a great all-weather, all-terrain remote sensing tool, and it is currently able to sort of provide images of the returned signal from the ground at scales of order 20 meters per pixel over hundreds of kilometers on a side. And the data is recorded at the satellite as complex data, meaning that both an amplitude and phase information is recorded. And then we take that phase information and can actually interfere it from two different time periods to actually make this interferogram, which is actually showing you contours of ground deformation. But it's not just ground deformation. It's ground deformation that's resolved. It's a one-dimension, you know, the ground deforms in a three-dimensional sense. And what you're looking at here is a one-dimensional image of that deformation as it's been resolved in the direction of the satellite. So I'll try to help you visualize what exactly you're looking at here next. All right, so let me just briefly, I briefly mentioned that we're measuring phase. Let's just simplistically look at what we're looking at here. Basically, how this works is that we're sending an electromagnetic beam down to the ground, and we're recording both the amplitude of the return signal and also the phase information. And so we're then going to difference the phase that's measured at two different time intervals that might be separated by weeks, months, or even years. And we're going to then difference that phase information, and we're going to have to apply some corrections basically to account for example, the phase is going to be different if we're viewing the ground from not identical points of view. So there's going to be what we would call a geometry effect, a baseline effect from the fact that the two sensors are not going to be in identical spots. There is also going to be some phase information from the fact that there's going to be topography if we're viewing from slightly different positions. Again, we're going to have a parallax effect if the ground is not completely of uniform height, so there's going to be some oscillations. And so that's what we're basically trying to show you here in this flow chart here of showing you the different steps that are involved in going from a raw radar scene that has phase and complex data and actually computing something that looks like a map of ground deformation, or at least phase change between the two time intervals. So what we're looking at here is, for example, a radar image here of the Zagros Mountains. You can hopefully see that there are these bands of mountains and dark areas that are valleys. This basically is the amplitude of the returned radar signal. It looks sort of just like what you might expect an optical image to look like. And the phase information looks like completely white noise, because the phase by itself is not a useful data point. It can oscillate from one pixel to the other depending on how exactly the phase is returned from this pixel size scattering area. So the pixel is of order 20 meters on a side. That is going to include a whole bunch of effects that are going to be buildings, people, rocks are going to contribute to what is going to be the phase of that particular scattering area. And so if you actually look at the raw phase, it's going to be rather meaningless. So what we're really interested in, though, is how has that phase changed from one time period to the next. So the next thing that we're going to look at is what we would call a raw interferogram, which in this case has a very high fringe rate, so high that you really probably can't resolve it, especially from the back row. But there's fringes basically going all across this image, and most of those fringes are simply due from the fact that the two satellites are several tens to hundreds of meters apart when they're making their observations. So a variety of people track these satellites, so we sort of know within a few centimeters of where these satellites are. We remove this, what we would call orbital effect, and then we're left with basically what we would call a flattened interferogram. In this case, the fringes that you see are completely related then to topography, because the first order cut that we've done, we just sort of assumed what we would call just a curved Earth that's going to only account for the fact that the Earth is smooth. Then we need to use what's called a digital elevation model, a map of topography of this given region, to remove these types of topographic effects. And then we're left with something that is going to be just the raw phase change between these two images once these corrections have been made. And this is where we might actually detect if there's been sort of some change in the surface of the ground, or alternatively, there might be some change in the composition of the atmosphere. So even though we're propagating at a few gigahertz or at a few centimeters wavelength, we can propagate through most clouds, but if there's still some bulk change, for example, in the water vapor content, that can change the propagation of these microwave beams between the two time intervals and cause some sort of phase signal. So we might have, we always have to worry about sort of changes in the atmosphere between two time intervals, but in general, if we have multiple scenes, there's going to be different realizations of the atmosphere. We can correct for that in one way. And then there are also other ground-based estimates and actually satellite measurements of the water vapor content of the atmosphere that can also be used to correct the images. All right, so I then promised you, first of all, to let you know a little bit about how you can visualize the cover of the Physics Today article that I was showing you earlier. And so that's what I'm going to try to step you through here next. So what we had here, as I showed you, are these red areas. This is the primary fault that ruptured during the BAM earthquake. It was what we would call a right lateral strike slip fault, meaning that in this case, the left-hand side of the fault moved to the north. And this is going to generate a three-dimensional displacement pattern, as you would see here on the right. So this is showing you the X component, the Y component, and the Z component. I won't spend too much time here, but you can see, for example, the Y component shows the left-hand side here moving primarily up, and the right-hand side is moving down to the south. You have this vertical component sort of as it's moving to the north. It causes uplift here, subsidence here, and uplift over here. All right, so that's the three-dimensional deformation field. But then we're only going to we're going to have to sort of visualize how to take that 3D component and resolve it in the direction of the radar satellite. So then we need to take the X component, a certain fraction of it, about 40% of the X component, about 10% of the Y component, about 90% of the Z component, and then we create this deformation field resolved into the line of sight of the satellite. And that's effectively what we have here. Now, the final step to think about is that we're only able to measure phase differences between 0 and 2 pi. So that means that we get basically one fringe of deformation every, in this case, about 3 centimeters. So we can only measure this, I think that's the last bullet I make here, is that we have then what we would call a wrapped image, which is going to have a fringe basically every 2 pi radians. In this case, we can convert that by knowing the wavelength of the radar is about 6 centimeters. We have divide that by 2 pi times 2 because the signal is going down and then coming back again. And that's where we get this factor of we get a fringe about every 3 centimeters. So this image here is identical to the one here except for the fact that it has been wrapped in the right here. And then once we get this is our raw measurement, we then sort of have to go back to this doing some algorithms for unwrapping. So effectively, even though you look at the Physics Today cover and it sort of looks like this very sort of, it looks like most of the deformation is here on the right. In fact, there was more or less equal deformation on this vertically dipping strike slip fault. It's just the fact that we had resolved more of the deformation on this side because the Z component of deformation, the Y component, and the X component add constructively on the right-hand side and destructively on the left-hand side. All right, so hopefully you can appreciate one of the most important things we need to do with radar interferometry is, yes, we have this great space-based tool to measure deformation at the order of sub-centimeters on the ground surface, but each individual measurement is only one component of the deformation field. And sort of to resolve the subsurface geophysical processes that are going on, we would like to have all three components. So ideally what we would have is multiple viewing geometries. Unfortunately, the satellite has to travel both from north to south and then again from south to north, so we can get two different viewing geometries in that regard. This particular satellite also has a beam which can be steered between roughly 15 degrees from vertical and about 45 degrees from vertical, so there are multiple measurements from that. And there's another tool that we have available to us that was, in fact, used to reconstruct the three-dimensional deformation field from this particular earthquake. And I tried to draw a very crude diagram here, and hopefully this will make sense to you. But essentially what we do is we can actually use not only the phase information from this particular radar data set, but we can also use the amplitude. So, for example, you imagine you have a bright pixel. Imagine it's a tree or something on one side of the fault. You take an image of that before the earthquake. You take an image of that after the earthquake. If it's moved several meters, you can sort of do a cross-correlation between the two SAR images and the amplitude and figure out that one portion of the image has moved relative to some other portions of the image which have moved much less. So this is what we would call pixel tracking. It's a completely horizontal measurement of deformation of the ground surface. It's a little less sensitive than interferometry. Interferometry is measuring sort of sub-wavelength, sub-centimeter scales. This is usually of order sub-pixel size, which is of order, in this case, a few tens of centimeters. but it's a completely complementary measurement of the ground deformation. So, for example, this Yuri Fialko here again took an interferogram here from what we would call a descending orbit, where it's going from north to south. This was on the cover. This is the complementary one going from the ascending, looking at it basically from the other direction. You can see that the pattern here then looks like the deformation is adding constructively on this other side of the fault relative to the east side. This then shows the pattern here of what we would call in this case, the azimuth offsets or the pixel tracking. And you combine these four observations together and you can reconstruct the three deformation components. And that's what they've done down here. This shows the horizontal deformation. This side of the fault is sort of moving to the north and a little bit out. And then this is showing the uplift here and subsidence over here. It's a little more, it's not completely symmetrical in this case because the fault has a little bit of a dip. The faulting along the fault plane is not completely uniform. But by using these different observations, you can then reconstruct the three-dimensional deformation field of an earthquake from space. So hopefully this is by itself interesting to you, because normally we would have to, previous measurements of ground deformation that have been made involve a lot of work to try to go out and do ground surveying. You would typically only have maybe a few, at best, 10 to 100 points of deformation. In this case, you have, in essence, tens of millions, and you need to be able to figure out how to actually use that information. Some of it's redundant, and you don't actually need all of it. You can sort of, but it's great to have a complete map of the deformation field right up to the fault trace. All right, so who cares? All right, so we've got these great measurements of the ground surface deformation. Of what can we learn that's of any interest? Well, let me just tell you one thing that was very interesting from this particular earthquake and a couple of other vertical strike slip earthquakes that has been resolved now that we can image fault deformation right up to the fault trace itself. And one is that there appears to be, from a lot of these earthquakes, what we would call a shallow slip deficit. So these are faults that rupture through the Earth's surface. In this case, there's a region that slips during the earthquake. Regions that are deeper are not going to be behaving completely elastically, so they might move in a more viscoelastic or even viscous motion between earthquakes. So we don't worry so much about what happens at great depths for this particular area of interest. But we have to wonder what's happening in the shallow regions. Why didn't the region of rupture go all the way to the surface for this particular earthquake? And in fact, several earthquakes here that have been studied here in Southern California and Turkey, as well as this one in Iran, all indicate that if we sort of take measurements of the slip as a function of depth, you can see that almost all of these earthquakes have a lack of slip in the near surface and some maximum of slip at several kilometers depth. So what's going on here? Is this a region that's going to slip during future earthquakes? Does this indicate that sort of this earthquake ruptured this portion of the fault at this time, and this portion up here is going to rupture later? Studies of longer-term deformation following these earthquakes in, for example, Southern California doesn't really bear that out. Another thing that can happen is these faults don't always slip and generate seismic waves. They sometimes slip what we would say aseismically, that they can just sort of deform the ground surface without generating earthquakes. Again, sort of we have ground deformation measurements after some of these events, and they don't seem to indicate that the meters of slip that's required is occurring in the shallow regions. So we're sort of left with a question that's sort of been raised by these new observations of earthquakes is there perhaps a region of bulk inelastic failure, sort of the idea that, okay, we have this single fault rupturing the Earth's subsurface in this region, in this depth range, but perhaps in the shallow regions where their pressures are less, where the rupture might be occurring over several smaller faults, it's not going to be resolved onto a single fault plane. But this is an area of active research that sort of has been facilitated by the fact that we have these now maps, images of deformation of the ground surface right up to the fault itself. Then let's talk about a couple of other things that we have learned in general about earthquakes. One is that we generally locate seismic events on the Earth's surface, including nuclear explosions, by triangulating effectively the acoustic waves that travel through the Earth's interior. And this is a very complicated problem, even though it's sort of just acoustic waves traveling through a mostly elastic medium, because the Earth is very heterogeneous. And that heterogeneity is reflected in trying to then take observations from the global networks and then invert for the locations of where these seismic sources were. So this particular shows another earthquake, a magnitude 5 event, a much smaller sort of nearly point source event in southern Iran that is located mislocated by tens to 50 kilometers here in this particular region. You can imagine that there's a lot of interest in locating precisely every seismic event in southern Iran to know whether things are happening, for example, at the purported nuclear test facilities, for example, or if they're happening 50 kilometers away. All right, so that's a sort of a security issue that might be a reason to get funding from the Department of Defense, but certainly seismologists are also interested in knowing. For example, if they're trying to take tomographic images of the Earth's interior, you need to know where your illumination sources are more precisely than what the current global catalogs can give us. So that gives us a good scientific motivation as well. Something I won't talk about a lot today, but it's also been a great boon to geophysical studies of the Earth's interior, is sort of the ability to sort of measure maps of deformation over the Earth's surface immediately after earthquakes. So you imagine you just sort of have this earthquake occurs, it sort of kicks the earth, and the earth continues to deform afterwards because it's not completely elastic material. And by making these precise observations, we've in fact learned that there some portions of the earth obey a power law of viscoelastic relations, and some areas are actually fluids moving around in them and are experiencing poroelastic deformation. And finally, I'll talk a little bit about how we might be able to detect some pre-seismic motions before some large earthquakes, and I'll be talking about that in Act 3. All right, so, okay, let's pretend you live in an area where there are no earthquakes, and you don't really care. Okay, so what can INSAR tell us about other phenomena? So I'll show you a couple of INSAR's other greatest hits, not my own myself, but that I think are just really revealing the power of this technique. And one is here showing you an image of Las Vegas. And Las Vegas, as you know, is in an arid area. It involves, to survive, they get some of their water from the Colorado River, but they also pump a lot of groundwater. They mine, effectively, groundwater from deep aquifers. And, in fact, the implications of this on the surface are that mining this groundwater is causing permanent deformation of the ground surface. And, in fact, this deformation is strongly controlled by the location of faults, where water sort of goes up against some sort of impermeable fault, or in some cases the faults may be permeable and actually increase water flow. So these images have sort of revealed and reinforced other types of ground-based measurements of the deformation in this area. An area that I'm starting to get interested in a little bit more is actually using this technique to monitor ice motion. So in this case, I'm showing you here an image of the ice streams of Antarctica into the Ross Ice Shelf that is showing the velocity here. So these streams are areas of very rapid ice motion, while other areas around them are not moving as rapidly. So INSAR is a great tool in these very inaccessible regions to actually record the velocities of ice in all the glaciers in Antarctica to get a better sense of the mass balance, the influence on sea level rise, and figure out if there's been any acceleration in the motion of these glaciers over the last 15 years for which we have data. Yes, go ahead. Feature tracking is the most popular method, although INSAR does work as well. But in general, you can imagine that what we need is that the scattering properties of the ground surface cannot change much between observations. So if, for example, you have a melting event on the surface of this glacier, it's going to totally change the scattering properties, and it's going to be basically incoherent. So you have to have a very rapid repeat track. So if you go fly over ice on timescales of less than a week, usually this works. But on time scale, the flow is mostly horizontal in this case. So in this case, you're resolving, again, you're only measuring the one component of deformation that you, in this case, it is mostly horizontal, but it also sort of, it has little bumps and, you know, it's not necessarily a smooth glacial flow down any given valley. It sort of has obstacles that it runs into, and also, so there's just some. Looking at interferograms of ice are really interesting because they sort of have these little bumps and wiggles, and there are subglacial melting events that might cause some uplift. Very fascinating. There's not a lot of INSAR data for these things. It's mostly done by feature tracking, but it's really revolutionizing ice. Actually, let me go back make my final point there. And that's just anthropogenic deformation, deformation from mining, in this case from oil extraction here in the Great Valley of California, has been monitored in this very active area. Again, just any sort of ground deformation at the order of millimeters to centimeters per year is detectable over most areas of the world. And let me talk a little bit about some of the caveats here. So I've told you about how great INSAR is. Let's now talk about what are the practical issues that we deal with. One is, okay, where do we get our data from? Often we have to buy data, mostly from the Europeans or from the Canadian Space Agency or from the Japanese. It's not clear how we're going to get data from their new satellite, but that's still being negotiated. But in any case, there are lots of INSAR satellites. Sort of the revolution occurred in the 1990s because of the launch of these two European satellites, ERS-1 and 2, and there's also a Japanese satellite. I should mention that these are all, some of these are operating at different wavelengths. So wavelength is important, as I'll show you a little bit later, in where we're able to make successful measurements. So getting access to data, they don't always acquire data over every region of the world, in part because none of these satellites, all of these satellites, I should say, are multi-sensor instruments. So there's multiple people competing for observing time, and SAR does not always get top priority. The other thing that is important for all of these satellites is orbital control. We need to actually have our observations repeating to almost the exact same location, because if we get from too far of a geometry away of order, if we're kilometers apart between overflights of a given area, then we start to get some decorrelation in the signal because we're basically viewing the scatterers on the ground from some greatly different angles. So it's important to be able to know where the satellite is and control its overflights. And that'll be important, as I'll talk about later in the talk, about sending INSAR missions to other planets. Orbital control is a serious issue. As I also mentioned before, atmospheric effects are important. This is, for example, showing some Lee waves off of the western slope of the Andes Mountains, showing these features here, which are not ground deformation, but are related to changes in the water vapor content just coming off the western slope here of the Andes. All right, and finally, I just wanted to make the pitch as to why it matters that some of these radars are at C-band, that's about 6 centimeters, and some of them are at 24 centimeters or at L-band. And why does that matter? So let me show you an example here from Hawaii. So if you've ever been to the eastern side of Hawaii, you know that there's Kilauea National Park, which is basically bare lava. But also just to the north here, there's essentially rainforest. And so it's very difficult to sort of maintain what we would say coherence of the ground scatterers between observations of an area where the scatterers are blowing in the wind effectively. Right, so if you have a wavelength of only 6 centimeters, it's going to effectively be scattered by particles on the ground that are of order 6 centimeters. So in this case, leaves on the trees. However, if you sort of go to a longer wavelength, something like 24 centimeters, you're going to be able to penetrate the canopy to some extent and sort of hit the bare tree or the bare ground itself. So this is showing you, for example, interferograms of Hawaii that show that sort of at L-band, you're able to get fringes available all over the east portion of the island. While at C-band, you have higher fringe density, sort of greater sensitivity to ground motion, but you're not able to make measurements in all locations. So this is particularly relevant, for example, if we want to study deformation in highly vegetated areas, or even areas with vegetation at all, like the areas that we all live in, and want to study ground deformation in them. On the other hand, areas that are urban don't undergo much ground change except for, of course, snowfall. And so urban areas maintain good correlation more or less year-round. All right, so let me now tell you a little bit about the correlation here in the region that I work in. It's a region that's here encompasses here the western portion of South America, here along an active plate boundary between where the Nazca Plate is subducting beneath South America, causing the rise of the Andes Mountains, large magnitude 8 earthquakes, and volcanic activity. So there are all lots of tectonic reasons to study this area, plus the fact that this area includes the Atacama Desert, an area where many people are building new telescopes, and also an area that is very dry. Areas of the Atacama Desert have no recorded precipitation in the last 150 years. So this is an area where the ground surface is not changing very much at all. It's an ideal place to sort of test out the technique. All right, so one of the fun things that we were able to do was actually to look at the approximately 1,000 volcanoes that occur here in the Andes to try to figure out which areas have magma moving beneath them and which ones don't. First of all, I just wanted to let you know a little bit about Volcanology 101 here in two slides. Basically, the idea is that at a volcano, we certainly have some obvious manifestations of magma moving beneath these in terms of eruptions, hot springs, all sorts of manifestations, but that doesn't necessarily mean if a volcano doesn't exhibit these that there's nothing happening there, that there's no magma moving beneath them. The basic idea is that you have the magma moving up through the Earth's crust, and it doesn't really start to generate, for example, seismic activity till it reaches the sort of the brittle region here, the cold outermost few kilometers of the Earth's surface where earthquakes can actually occur, but that magma can sort of move sort of more or less undetected through most of the regions here beneath a given volcano, except for the fact that it might cause some small-scale deformation of the Earth's surface. All right, so you might ask the question, all right, who cares if volcanoes in the remote Andes where nobody lives are actively moving? If you've ever taken sort of a large international flight, for example, over to Asia, you have flown over many numerous volcanoes that have actually damaged several large jetliners because they flew unsuspected through volcanic ash plumes. And let me tell you, the very glassy silicic material that comes out of that's in these ash plumes is not very friendly to jumbo jet engines. So that's not something you want to have happen if you can avoid it. All right, so that gives you hopefully some reason to believe that studying volcanoes even in remote areas is interesting. Also, scientifically, we want to understand the life cycle of these volcanoes. You know, Mount St. Helens, for example, erupted catastrophically in 1980, and it was something like 120 years before it since its previous eruption, and effectively it appeared dormant to the rest of the world for 118 years out of that 120 years. Do volcanoes do anything in the intervening time that gives us any clue that there might be volcanic activity? And in some cases, the answer is yes, and in some cases, volcanoes appear to be trying to deceive us in some sense. So some volcanoes, basically this is just an argument that we need to study every volcano that we possibly can because they all behave differently in some respect. And that's because some volcanoes appear to have a very cyclic pattern, meaning that you have, for example, the basaltic volcanoes in Iceland and in Hawaii have this sort of pattern where the ground surface inflates as the magma chamber fills up, the magma chamber empties, you get this deflation event, and then it refills and recycles, and you get this very sort of sawtooth pattern that you could sort of start to think about predicting things. However, there are some volcanoes that have erupted for decades. For example, Long Valley Caldera in California has been deforming for 25 years with no eruption. So people have sort of are not as worried as they once might have been, but certainly a reason to continue to monitor. And in fact, there are also volcanoes that appear to erupt and don't cause any deformation of the ground surface. So fundamentally, we just believe that we need to monitor all volcanoes. So that's effectively what we try to do here in the central Andes. I'm just showing you here. Hopefully you can see that there's a whole bunch of little dots. There are approximately 1,100 volcanoes that are mapped throughout the central Andes. Perhaps 50 of them were believed to be potentially active, meaning they'd erupted in the last 10,000 years or so. And so these show the radar images that we looked at for these particular volcanoes. We tried to maximize the coverage, and we got about 1,000 of them and all the potentially active ones. And the surprising thing to us was that of these 50 potentially active volcanoes that were sort of believed to be active because they had eruptions or fumaroles or hot springs, none of them were actively had magma moving beneath them, but that we found four areas of magmatic deformation, and that all of these were areas that had been previously unsuspected or of having activity or that were completely dormant. So let's talk a little bit in detail about a couple of these. And one was particularly confusing or interesting. depending on how you want to look at it. And that this is showing you here an optical image of the region that was deforming. In this case, it's deforming at a rate of about 1 or 2 centimeters per year. So if you're standing here at this volcano, it's at a rate that you're not really going to be able to detect. Just standing there yourself on the ground, it's something you're going to have to measure with some precise geodetic measurements. But this was actually even occurring in a region that nobody would have looked in before, because here's a volcano here. You can hopefully see that there's a large lava flow. Here's a couple of volcanic craters down here with lava flows, and the region that's deforming is somewhere in between them. So the question is this a magma chamber here that's related to eruptive activity at either of these volcanoes, or is this somehow some sort of the birth of a new volcano, or just some random intrusion of magma into an area that's never going to get magma again? So we went down there just to see if there were any obvious surface manifestations of activity in this area. And this shows you here the volcano that's just to the north called Listaria, which has been fumarolically active for decades. But we again see nothing here in the region in between the volcanoes. So there's no surface manifestation of activity here. And so you might say, okay, well, maybe our observations from space are suspect. But fortunately, they've been verified by independent groups and some of the different satellites. So at least there's some confirmation in that regard. I think I will skip this point. And the next question is then, okay, we've figured out which areas might have magmatic activity, and then we want to understand, first of all, how deep these magma chambers might be, and then how much magma might be moving beneath them. And so we use most of the models that we've used at this point are just simple elastic models, where we sort of just imagine you have a balloon effectively in some sort of elastic medium, and you're just asking how is the surface deformed from inflating or deflating this particular sort of chamber. And sort of they all sort of look like bullseyes because in this particular case of the central Andes, the sources are axisymmetric. Most of the deformation is occurring in the center. It diminishes as you go out to the sides. So effectively what you're seeing here are contours of deformation with the most deformation here in the middle at a rate of, in this case, of about 2 centimeters per year, diminishing out to zero about that point. All right, so I'm running out of time here, but I will at least mention briefly how we think about modeling these deformation sources. And so these types of observations are non-unique, meaning that you can come up with several different types of models to explain the deformation patterns, especially if you only have one component of deformation. So unfortunately here in South America, we really only have deformation measurements from one type of orbit of this particular area, from the descending satellite orbits. So effectively we're only getting one component of the three-dimensional deformation field, and that's problematic, as I'll show you here from some theoretical models. This is showing you here different sources of deformation, which are spherical, shaped like, an American or Canadian football, perhaps as a frisbee, different sources of deformation that have sort of been observed geologically. This would be a sort of a sill, and this would be something that looks perhaps more like a pluton. But in any case, all of these different sources of deformation have different patterns of surface displacement, unless you move them to different depths. And in this case, all of these different source geometries produce identical vertical deformation sources here at the top. And if you only had one component of deformation, in this case mostly vertical, you would not be able to resolve which is the source geometry and what was the depth and what was the inferred volume of this particular magma chamber. In this case, it shows that the horizontal deformation will clearly resolve this point, but unfortunately, for these observations from the 90s, we didn't have that data. So this just sort of shows you the spread using all sorts of different types of models as to what the source depth of these different sources are. In this case, the volcano I was showing you here in Bolivia has among the deepest magma chambers that we've imaged anywhere in the world at depths of about 15 to 20 kilometers below sea level, and because this is on the Altiplano, the high plateau, that's actually about, you can add on an extra 5 kilometers basically between the surface and the sources of deformation from this particular volcanic event. The other question you can ask is not only how deep is the magma chamber, what is the rate of activity there, but how time variable is it? And so this is just sort of showing you here as a function of time, with error bars, sort of the inferred rates of magma flux into these particular different areas and showing you that all of these different sources of deformation are time variable over time scales less than a few years. We've seen one source here in Peru turn off. We've seen a source here in on the border between Chile and Argentina turn on, and all of these other ones have changed rates. So all of these systems are very dynamic, and the magma flux that's coming up to them is not completely steady state. It seems to be changing on the shortest even time scales that we're able to observe these. So an important question then is, okay, well, we've done this in the central Andes. How representative are these results of the rest of the world? So we only found, in essence, four volcanoes out of the 50 that were believed to be potentially active in this area. How representative that is this a special case or is this unique? Well, unfortunately, we can't really do a global census of all the volcanoes in the world, in part because the data isn't yet available. And it's, again, a question of sort of not having a dedicated mission yet to make these observations. But we can at least do some comparisons in some areas of the world that have been well surveyed. Alaska is an area that has been extremely well surveyed by the United States Geological Survey. And they found in this area, for example, that there are about 9 different centers of volcanic deformation. You see bullseyes, you see things that are more complicated related to dike intrusions and swarms of seismicity. So things were looked relatively simple in the Andes because they all, everything just sort of looked like this, but other volcanoes indicate multiple sources of deformation. All right, so this is just giving you a snapshot of what we can do by monitoring volcanoes around the world, but what have we learned? And hopefully the most important point is that something about the volcano lifestyle or life cycle. The lifestyle of volcanoes is, again, very different. I can tell you the volcanoes in Hawaii have a different lifestyle than the ones in elevation in the Andes. But in any case, we've seen magmatic intrusions that appear to have no immediate eruptive threat. That sort of these magma sort of comes up in these areas, sits around for a while, more magma comes up. It seems to take perhaps hundreds of these intrusions to lead to eruptions, at least in some areas. Other areas are appear to have an eruption every time there's an intrusion. I think the other point I want to make here is that there are different rates of activity in different arcs. So I sort of showed you the Alaska example because, let's just return to that in a second, is that the central Andes have, depending on how you count, have about the same number of volcanoes as the Alaska-Aleutian Arc. But the levels of activity in these two different volcanic areas are very different. And so that raises a lot of questions as to why. Is there something different about the tectonic regimes here between the central Andes and Alaska that makes this area a lot more volcanically active, even if they sort of have the same number of volcanoes, the same sort of magma flux in those two different regions? And a couple of things that you can think of is that the central Andes, sort of the magma has a larger path to travel through to get to the surface in the central Andes, where it has a large mountain chain of crustal material, which is almost 70 kilometers thick, while in Alaska this pile is perhaps half that thick. And so the magma doesn't have as much region to sort of difficult low-density material to travel through before it reaches the surface. All right, so I think that leaves us about 5 minutes left, so I think I'm actually going to skip Act 3 here. And we're not going to talk much about earthquakes, but I wanted to just give you a flavor. Yes, too much. All right. All right. Whoa. All right, so this is, in some sense, hopefully a summary figure that you can appreciate now that you sort of know what you're looking at. That sort of, I think it was on the posters that went around, and I'll just try to describe to you what you're looking at. So first of all, you should now at least be familiar somewhat with these bullseyes here, which are related to volcanic inflation in 3 different areas and deflation at 1 area here in Argentina. And what you're going to see here, these little bullseyes look more or less like pimples in comparison to these even larger fringes that are sort of related closer to the coast. And these are all over here, in this case, magnitude 8 earthquakes. So these are producing meter-scale deformation of the ground surface as opposed to the centimeter-scale per year deformation in the magmatic intrusions. And so what you're effectively seeing here along the coast in this case, are thrusting events where South America is being thrust over this region of the Nazca Plate, this oceanic plate, which is subducting down into the deep earth interior in this region, and the sliding of the South American plate beneath, the sliding of the Nazca Plate beneath South America is not necessarily a smooth, steady-state project. It's jerky. It generates large earthquakes that generate large movements of the Earth's surface. In this case, you're all seeing these sort of bullseyes that are related to subsidence of the ground as this sort of region offshore gets thrust up into the air. So this is sort of giving you hopefully a sense that even within this region, in this case we've surveyed an area that's about a million square kilometers. In fact, that's about the size of Ontario. An area, so you should be somewhat familiar with how big this area is, indicating myriad types of tectonic activity, large earthquakes over the last decade. I didn't have time to talk to you about some of the anthropogenic deformation that we see related, again, to groundwater pumping. There are several large-scale mines throughout the region here that we see some small-scale deformation related to, but certainly at this scale here that we've zoomed out to of several thousand kilometers on a side, nothing that you would really be able to appreciate. So magnitude 8 earthquakes always look a little more impressive. All right, so let me just try to give you a summary of what we've learned from INSAR and what the future directions will be. So hopefully you've learned a little bit about magma. We've also been able to detect motion of the ground surface related that occurs right before earthquakes that might be useful in the future for sort of assessing, making short-term predictions, but it certainly is not true that every fault in the world indicates some sort of pre-seismic motion. We can rule that out. It appears to be only under certain special circumstances that we can sort of see the ground slowly start to move and then start to accelerate into a large earthquake. That only happens under special circumstances. And some of these other things I've sort of summarized. Over the near term, there's going to be larger data sets available as we sort of not only mine the last 15 years' worth of data, which we're slowly getting our hands on, but new data sets. There's currently three SARS satellites, and there's going to be more, another one launched next year. And not only more data, but also data available at L-band, which will open up new areas of deformation. This is showing you a new signal processing technique, which is focusing more on areas that are coherent in multiple images, even if the scene is not completely continuous. This is showing you here New Orleans. That's showing you, for example, along the levee here that actually failed, that there was very high rates of subsidence of order several centimeters per year that was not really detected by any other means. So this is an area that will be, even in an area like New Orleans here along the levee, they're able to study the deformation. So this sort of new signal processing tools will be a useful thing. And then over the longer term, we're hoping to convince people that, yes, it's very useful to monitor the ground deformation. It tells us about a lot of scientific problems, but also practical and applied problems that are useful, but that also can reveal some of the basic physics of the processes that are going on in the Earth. And this might be enhanced by having constellations of satellites that can measure things in almost real time, or at least on a daily or weekly basis. Also, people are talking about putting a SAR in geostationary orbit, which would be difficult because most of these satellites here are orbiting of order 800 kilometers. You put something out, you know, two orders of magnitude further than that, and you know, you have some serious issues with signal to noise and sort of getting a signal to propagate to the Earth and propagate out to the satellite. And the final thing I wanted to at least mention to you today is this is a remote sensing tool that in theory could work anywhere in the solar system where there's deformation occurring. So I at least wanted to talk to you briefly about what some of the people at JPL are thinking about in terms of this. And I wanted to show you first the first planetary interferogram made by, in this case, the Magellan spacecraft at Venus. This is something that's not seen very often. I just got a copy of this slide from Scott Hensley at JPL. Effectively, Magellan was a SAR mission, the only planetary SAR mission. It orbited Venus in the early 90s. The issue here was that you didn't have a lot of repeating orbits that were in the exact same location, so it was difficult to sort of get the repeat pass to do the interferometry. In this case, they're sort of over the North Polar region, so these images are only separated by 6 hours, You don't expect a lot to happen in 6 hours, but in this case, they actually did get fringes, which is a pretty phenomenal thing. So if we send another SAR mission to Venus, maybe we could detect some actual motion. Any sort of planetary SAR mission is going to have a major difficulty in that these are very memory-intensive data sets, and sort of getting the data back down to Earth is going to be challenging, especially if you're trying to image the entire planet and do a global survey, because you don't necessarily know, you don't have people on the ground telling you there was just an earthquake over here, so you need to look there. You need to sort of look everywhere all the time to figure out where the deformation might be occurring. So that's a challenge, but something that's certainly getting easier every year. Both the French and JPL have been thinking about, of course, missions to Mars. There's a lot of interest in Mars. Repeat paths INSAR would be possible there. One of the issues is, as I mentioned earlier, controlling the orbits precisely enough to be able to get overflies within a few hundred meters over the course of several consecutive orbits. Something that will be challenging, but is several studies have shown is possible. The moon, we'll be sending a SAR mission there before the end of the decade, but I don't think there's going to be a lot of deformation on the moon for us to detect. Even though I like the moon, I'm not sure that sending an INSAR mission there is the highest priority. Europa, Io, the Galilean satellites, of course, have extreme deformation on the surface. It's again going to be difficult to control the orbits, but if you're very interested in this, there's a paper by Dave Sandwell that came out a few years ago where they talked about the issues involved in the Europa or Io mission. This is back when they were thinking of sending a nuclear-powered JIMO mission to Europa and Io. And with a nuclear-powered mission, you have lots of power available. You can actually use a SAR in that sort of configuration. Not clear that's ever going to happen again. At Titan, the Saturnian satellite, which is of great interest because it has lakes, all sorts of interesting things happening on it, is currently being visited by the Cassini radar, but it's very unlikely that this particular mission will ever produce interferograms. All right, so I think that is all I wanted to say today, and thanks for your attention. Yes, Yellowstone has been studied by people, again, at the USGS, and Yellowstone is a fascinating area because it appears to be very complicated, because it's an area that is both moving up and down. The Earth really seems to be breathing in this particular location. It's sort of the source of deformation sort of moves between the, I don't know how familiar you are, but there's two different large domes in that particular region. It sort of moves from one dome to the other. It's sort of believed that this sort of super dynamic system is not completely magmatically controlled, that we know that there's a large hydrothermal system there where sort of steam and hot fluids are moving around that aren't necessarily magmatic. So Yellowstone, yes, is deforming in complicated ways, and it sort of appears to be mostly related to hydrothermal activities as well as sort of a deeper magma chamber that might be slowly inflating and periodically inflating. So Yellowstone is definitely an area that's being monitored very closely to try to figure out both from INSAR and some things on the ground.
I was interested at one time in the October earthquake in Kashmir. Uh-huh. And I was looking at for the interferometry mm-hmm. there, and they couldn't get amplitude for some time.
Yeah, I think, I don't know super much about the Kashmir thing. I think I've seen some interferograms for the Kashmir earthquake, although they might be very spotty. It's not the complete deformation field, it's only small portions of it. In Kashmir, it was in October, and I don't know, it is sort of a lot of bare rock in that area, but I think that there is also, there might have been snow at the time, or snow immediately before the subsequent observations. So, basically, any observations you're doing in Yellowstone, for example, you have to do basically from summer to summer, because any time there's a snow there, it's going to change the scattering properties of the ground. So I'm not particularly sure about what happened in Kashmir, but my guess would be snow. And even if it is bare rock, you know, when you have a large earthquake, you're going to shake the ground up, cause lots of small-scale landslides and so forth, too. So I don't know how much of a factor that was in that particular earthquake, but certainly a lot of interest in that earthquake.
Of the oceans, like the Indian Ocean tsunami, for example, it might be a big split. Can you average up the water waves and see a change in the ocean level?
It's hard to do on repeat passes of longer than a few microseconds or milliseconds, I should say. So, because the scattering properties of the ocean are changing on a very dynamic time scale. So we can't really do an overflight of that area. But people have proven that they can map ocean currents with basically an airborne system like this. So basically you have an antenna at the start of the airplane, you have an antenna at the back of the airplane, and you do an interferometry between the two antennas on the airplane itself. And you can actually map ocean currents in this particular way. So so that is something that people have proven to do. Could they do that for the Indian Ocean tsunami? Presumably, but you sort of have to have an airplane up there at the right time to sort of catch that thing. That's right. And you could, in theory, measure the ground deformation as long as it's on the ground. You can't you can't measure things below the water. We were talking a little bit earlier with some people about, doing INSAR with sonar or something like this, and I'm not an oceanographer or an expert in those techniques, but it's difficult. There is ground deformation. It's hard to do in Sumatra, though, and this sort of is one of the limits of INSAR is that, number one, the tsunami wiped out the ground surface in a lot of the areas that were deformed heavily, right? So you sort of washed away the beach and all the scattering properties, or, Sumatra, it's a jungle, and it's hard to do interferometry with these things. So, it's certainly a great tool, not necessarily useful in every case that we might care about, unfortunately. That's right. Yes, and we've been trying to sell it, trying to sell it to NASA or any space agency for 15 years. And
no satellite is made for interferometry.
That's right. And it would be great because then not only might you be able to focus on areas that you care about, you might get the longer wavelength, and I think it would really be a revolutionary technique because you might be able to map larger areas of the Earth and monitor the deformation. I'm lucky if I get 3 observations per year over some portions of South America, and in theory, the satellite's flying over every month. So you would do a lot better in terms of a time series as well if you had a dedicated mission. So unfortunately, at least at NASA, climate change is also very important, has been sort of a higher priority for the last couple calls, but I think it's inevitable. That's right. It's very complementary in several regards. I was just talking with Georgia here about, for example, studying ice sheets and groundwater. So you can study the gravitational perturbation, but you can also study the deformation as well. And so, for example, let me pull back the wool. Studying these magmatic events, we're not even sure that it's, as I said, if it's magma or groundwater. Right, something's causing inflation, and I can make some plausibility arguments that it's magma, but it could be just sort of pressure increasing in these magma chambers and not necessarily any new addition of material, just sort of pressurizing the system and causing ground deformation. So being able to measure the gravity to know whether you're actually adding new material there that's going to cause an increased gravitational signal or just have the same amount of material and you're just somehow boiling it and causing it to have a larger pressure change would be essential. Unfortunately, GRACE is sort of too coarse to measure this sort of small-scale little pimples that we're talking about here in South America, but at least for larger scale, like water basin-type scales or ice sheets, the two methods are very complementary. All right, thanks.